rivers could talk, they'd call you
up. Yeah, how's it going?
Good. Good, yeah.
Nice.
I'm busy.
Yeah, seems like it. The book was great, by the way.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, it was learned a lot. The Irwins are like really interesting to me.
Yeah, I think that's really this a big part of the story, obviously, but like even something that could be looked into a bit further, like that kind of person, right?
Yeah.
It's a unique person, unique family.
Yeah, the political angle was really interesting. So yeah, I mean, I can kind of start whenever. I'm pretty much good to go. I usually start off like with an introduction. So if you want to introduce yourself and we just kind of like riff from there. This is Matt Shaw, who just published a great book called American Modern. It takes place in Columbus, Indiana, which is this really sort of unique experiment where private industrialists sort of pool together money to create this high modernist small city full of avant-garde architecture and public works and you know, getting people from all over the globe, from like Eero Saarinen to Charles Eames. And it's a really interesting project, and it kind of fits with the ongoing theme of this show of, I don't know, you could say how to improve public space, you know, especially specifically in America. So yeah, this is Matt Shaw. He's been on the show before, and the book is beautiful. It's amazing. So yeah.
Thanks. My name's Matt. I'm a writer in New York. I've been working for some different publications around here, writing about architecture, art, etc. And just finished this book up. I've also been teaching a lot at some schools out here, and also in Los Angeles, places like SciArc, Cooper Union, and NJIT. Wearing many hats right now, but yeah, excited to talk about this book. Because I think I'll be interested to hear your take on it and get into some of these themes that I think are underlying some of it that kind of need to be teased out.
So what got you, because you grew up in the area, right?
Yeah, I grew up in Columbus. I went to one of the schools designed by Norman Fletcher and of the Architects Collaborative, which was Walter Gropius's firm. Sort of a classic,
yeah,
you know, East Coast modernist firm. They had designed a lot of schools, and they designed this school in Columbus. So I went to it. It's called Parkside. And then went to Northside, which was a nice building by Harry Weiss, a Chicago architect who's kind of been forgotten about. And then went to the high school in town, which had served as the inspiration for the town to improve their architecture. So I went to the last bad building. And so it was kind of fun when I was writing the book to find out that my high school was the one that no one liked. So I got to write about that, which is cool. But yeah, I grew up there, and you know, my dad worked for Cummins, which was the big company there that did a lot of the architecture. He worked in their main office building. So I'd go visit him and, you know, have these kind of experiences that at the time I didn't realize like what they were, but I think that they're sort of like aesthetic experiences that do really elevate the way you like perceive the world, even if you don't realize it. But I think growing up around that kind of level of aesthetics does make you a little bit more aware of your surroundings. So it took me a while to figure out like what it means to have grown up there, but I think it instills in you like not only like that aesthetic sensibility, but also like a sense of kind of like pride about where you're at, you know. Having all this architecture there reminds you of kind of people's investment in the place.
Right. And that's a really good point, because I sort of think about some of the aesthetic motifs that I go back to in the neighborhood that I grew up in, which has really sort of changed a lot. Actually, that's not entirely true. It more or less looks exactly the same as when I was a kid. There's just other shit built around it. But one of the things that I found really interesting about this book is this idea of kind of like social experimenting with, you could say, more traditionally inclined populace, but sort of like integrating these modernist or sort of futuristic visuals into the sort of like broader public space or broader public life. I think that's kind of like really missing from society today. And it doesn't really seem like people want to pick up the mantle for that. And it's kind of like a hard problem to solve, you know? And I've sort of been sort of like going through my mind, like why that is. Like, why is it that we've sort of just like given up on making, because it seems pretty obvious to me that, you know, you make a place look cooler, it inspires people to do better. Like, what happened here?
Yeah, I do think that's like one of the main legacies of it, is that it's inspired people. So I guess like the way that this all came about was, you know, that they saw that high school, and they had two Fortune 500 companies in this town, Cummins and one called Arvin. And there was another one that was called Costco, not Costco like Costco guys, but like Costco, like it's furniture. You might see it all over, but high chairs and stuff. But they had these three Fortune 500-ish companies. Two of them were Fortune 500. And, you know, they were just like trying to build up this town after World War II in like whatever way they could, trying to modernize it, right? Like, it's in the middle of Indiana, but it's also kind of like an industrial center in some ways at this time. And so they're trying to figure out like how to make it better, and eventually how to compete with the coasts for talent, right? Like trying to get people from Harvard MBA school to come to a small town in Indiana and pry them away from like IBM or AT&T or whatever. So they were trying to improve things pretty pragmatically, and they ended up enlisting all these architects to come and build these buildings, starting with schools and housing, the basic things they needed to house this post-war boom. And then it kind of spread out into like civic buildings and everything else. But it actually really started with churches. The first building that they, you know, the family, the Irwin Sweeney Miller family, who was this kind of major industrial family in the region, also a banking family, around the turn of the century, and it got big and started all these little industries, industrial businesses. They invited in Eliel Saarinen from Cranbrook Academy up in Michigan to come down and design this church. And they brought with them Eero Saarinen, their son. And so their son, Eliel's son, Eero, and the Irwin Sweeney Miller family's son, Irwin, became friends because they weren't like invited to the meetings about the building. They were like the kids. They had to go and, you know, eat at this ice cream parlor, and they became friends, and Charles Eames was there as well. And this was in the 30s, and they just became friends. And so when, in the 50s, when they wanted to build housing, they just called up Eero Saarinen. He's like, well, sorry, I'm building like the St. Louis Arch and the TWA terminal at Dulles Airport and the CVS building and GM Technical Center. Like, I'm a little busy for your little housing project. But so he gave him a list of people he liked, younger firms from Chicago. And they picked from this list, and it sort of started this chain reaction where 80 buildings or something have been built so far by famous architects. And, you know, like you said, it was kind of in this small town where where they were doing this. So they couldn't, it wasn't a patron model really. So there's a difference between like a patron and a client, I guess. A patron might just enlist whoever they want. And you'll see this like in Texas with like the Bass family in Fort Worth. Like, they were sort of just hiring these architects and building museums and putting their name on it. Not to say there's anything wrong with that, but the Manils as well in Houston.
Exactly.
They just like, they get their guy and they build it. There's a little different in this client model where they're working with like a school board or like, you know, a civic agency or even a church committee. They can't really just like, the family can't really just like put their stamp on it. They have to sort of work to modulate their elite, like avant-garde taste with the sort of everydayness of the place. And so they developed this model where they were, they would pay the architects fees for the architect, as long as the board picked from a list that they gave them. So it's sort of like sharing power and like kind of like a soft influence that they had. I mean, not to like undercut their influence and their money and their power, but they did like figure out a way that got everybody on board.
Right. Yeah, that's actually interesting because you brought up R. Edward Freeman's book, Strategic Management, which is sort of like codified the stakeholder model of, you could almost say like, it's like private responsibility to a kind of like shared public ownership. And that was actually really sort of interesting to me. Just kind of like the morality that kind of shaped the city. You know, it wasn't sort of tip, you know, like when you think of, when you talked about like shareholders, like the Manils or somebody who's like just putting their name on it, it's like a vanity project. This was very sort of like civic and communally minded first and foremost. And one of the things that I sort of think about now is like, why can't we have that anymore? Is it, you understand this way better than I do because you're actually in architecture. What is it about the current times that doesn't facilitate this? And you also mentioned a sort of dip in this style of community and architecture building in like the 1980s when risk management became sort of a big thing during the Reagan administration.
Yeah. The risk management thing is definitely like something, I mean, that's one of the most important things I think where, yeah, but going back a little bit before we get into that, like the stakeholder theory part of it, some people say that Erwin Miller, who was the kind of protagonist of all of this, that he was the client and the guy that brought in all these architects through his connections with Eero Saarinen and everyone. Some people kind of say that he was one of the people who sort of invented that model. He didn't call it stakeholder, but he was, he gave a speech at Dartmouth in, I believe, 1956, where he kind of laid out what people recognize later as stakeholder theory, which was that we don't only, the business as a kind of participant in society is not only responsible to its shareholders, but to the community it's in, to its workers, to a host of other people who are affected by the business. And so that is kind of what stakeholder is, right? It's not just shareholder, it's stakeholder. And so in Columbus, I think the way that played out was people felt like they had to give back partly to create a better place, their workers, you know? I think there was a Bible quote, I forget what it was, but it was something about like, you know, you have to like grow your tree in fertile soil, basically. And so, you know, for business, that meant like making sure that the community was strong that you were in because the business would be more successful. But I also think that it comes from like a dual purpose, which is business, but also they had a real, you know, responsibility to their neighbors, to the public, to making things beautiful and prosperous for everyone, coming from, you know, the religion of the time. And so, you know, there's a great quote Miller used to use that was saying, you know, it said basically, when you reap your harvest, you shouldn't reap to the edge of your field. And I think that's like an amazing architectural theory quote from Leviticus that was about, you know, not taking as much as you can from a site, right? So you see today all these Texas donuts in places like, you know, Brooklyn or Austin or Portland, et cetera, everywhere, Bloomington, Indiana, where they just are like plowing through whole blocks of the city with these big housing projects, 5-over-1 mixed use projects that just go right up to this edge of the street, have like really no street presence, no real aesthetic, you know, consideration for what the public realm will look like. It's because they go right up to the edge of the street and don't have that kind of like, they don't give back that edge of the field. And so all the buildings in Columbus all have like kind of a major public space in front of them. Collected together, these individual contributions to the public sphere become kind of the public sphere. This guy, Charles Moore, who was a kind of wild, wild mid-century architect, kind of a postmodernist who spent time in Berkeley in the middle 60s. And he had this great quote about, you know, that the public realm is really just the all the public, all the private citizens giving something up to it. So you have every private contribution, meaning buildings, has to, you know, consider its place within that public sphere. So I think those two quotes together kind of give outline a nice underpinning theory of Columbus and of how people thought about things a bit differently back then.
Yeah. And, you know, even Eero Saarinen, he had this one quote. He's like, we should stop thinking of individual buildings and look at the spaces and relationships to that the buildings create with others, which is, I mean, it's a pretty common architectural motif of that period. You know, there was no, like, people weren't thinking, you know, in this Taylorist model about, you know, just pure economic utilitarianism, especially, I think, the post-war boom also created, like, you could say, like, a pang of temporary solidarity that we don't see much of today. And that I think, you know, it's really sort of interesting to see how these individuals had sort of similar visions, though, and how that kind of, like, could potentially shape a place. Like, right now, it almost seems like individuals are so fragmented in what they want and how many, you know, particular ways there are of going about things. It almost seems like we're a bit paralyzed at the moment.
It's kind of hard to really compare the two eras because, I mean, a lot of what they were developing back then came from this idea of, like, prosperity.
Right.
That era was just so prosperous. They couldn't even imagine. A lot of the bad ideas today come from that time, I think. Like, this idea that, like, stakeholder theory has also been kind of, like, co-opted to, you could maybe draw a line between the idea that the business as a responsible citizen leads to Citizens United, you know, like, where all of a sudden, you're a person. So, you know, we're people, we have responsibilities, so we can also, like, influence election. I mean, the idea of, like, the idea of business giving back too has sort of been co-opted a little bit, like, into greenwashing or pinkwashing or whatever. A lot of that social stuff from 60s and 70s has been turned into, like, neoliberalism. It's a little bit hard for us to understand back then how progressive these ideas were, probably. It was like coming out of World War II, it was like unthinkable prosperity. And, like, the idea that we wouldn't be prosperous was also kind of unthinkable. Like, they were just like, progress is going to go on forever, you know, and prosperity will. So it probably was easier to get people on board with, we're doing this, like, let's do it. It's going to be great. Whereas today it's like, there's just so many, like, failures and, like, bad actors, maybe, not that there weren't back then, but we're more aware of it or something now. Like, you know, it is harder to build that consensus, I think, because building things is fraught with a lot of kind of bureaucracy and, I don't know, naysayers or something that it doesn't seem like they had back then.
That's a really good point. It does seem to be like, back then you could just kind of, like, more organically do things, though, too. You know, it didn't seem necessarily like you needed some broad consensus. Like, you're talking about, like, Saarinen and Eero and Irwin, like, met eating ice cream. You know, there seemed to be, like, especially, I guess, when you come from, like, prominent families, you could sort of get together and sort of stake out, like, a clear vision than you could potentially do now, because I think the bottom line is just kind of, like, not to say that there's not ideological aims, but would you say that we need, like, more state intervention or less? Because I've seen, like, both sides of the argument here. It's kind of a weird problem to think through.
Well, yeah, back then they had massive state intervention, right? Like,
yeah.
That was kind of part of what happened in the 70s was that, you know, some of these things had grown pretty big. And you had also, not all state interventions were necessarily seen as, like, great. Robert Moses chopping up the cities with New York City with his highways. Like, so people would kind of become a little bit wary of that. So maybe there was more trust back then in state intervention. For sure there was, especially, like, maybe in the 50s, 60s. But yeah, I mean, I think the main problem today is that we just sort of culturally lost our, I think it's more on the private sector that needs to, like, get its shit together. I know that seems kind of, like, obvious and broad, but I think that's where really this kind of change could happen, is if more people took on these ideas that, like, the public sector is kind of an attitude towards society, right?
Right.
So there's like the public sector is like that's why when I go to Columbus and I look at these buildings, I feel like, wow, someone really cared about people.
Right.
You know, they built these buildings with a real attitude that we're going to give something beautiful and good for people. Like the public library there was designed by Ian Pei, and out in front there's a Henry Moore sculpture. And it's like one of those beautiful places you could ever go. And part of what inspired me to do the book was I'd go in there and there'd be like these little kids from the country of Indiana and like wearing like camo and stuff, using the computers there to get on the internet. So they probably didn't have it at home. And so that image of like this, you know, international modernist building, this beautiful like waffle slab, you know, it looks like it's a lot like Boston and City Hall in some ways. It's got this like super beautiful institutional architecture. And then there's these like little, you know, little kids from rural Indiana using it. And so this idea that someone would give back like that, that's what you don't feel a lot today, right? Like,
right.
It feels like everything's kind of like, I mean, maybe this is also just New York a little bit, but like you just sort of feel like the public realm's set up to abstract from you. It's like, or to give you the bare minimum, you know, like you're just being like shuttled through these places and people are, and it's also like those housing projects are like just people trying to get as much money out of that site as they can and not give anything back. They don't care. And I think it's that kind of attitude towards the public realm that people have forgotten about. And maybe it is because of fragmentation a little bit, like people don't give a shit about the public realm because they don't see it as, maybe they don't see themselves as part of it or something.
Right. It's that sort of like Thatcherite, we don't live in a society thing that sort of took over in the 1980s.
Yeah.
And, you know, part of it, I do wonder, it's like, do we not live in a, is that just the way things are? Should we just adjust our expectations to that? Or do we sort of, I'm an optimist and I sort of think we can sort of reclaim our humanism a bit, especially when LLMs are going to, you know, actively replace our language production model and not do a very good job of it. It's going to have to like force us to step our game up a little bit because, I just don't think anybody's really sort of stepping up to the plate and doing things that are impressive enough to sort of like warrant our position within, I don't know, the arts or production. You know, we've just become this nation of consumers. And I think it's really strange because you had like a Jean Tanguay sculpture in the Commons area there. You know, like he was like a big artist that I liked when I was like a little kid with his like sort of Dadaist abstraction, sort of like childlike mobiles. And, you know, he had Alexander Girard, who I really want to talk about him and his, what he did in Columbus, because he's great.
Yeah. Both of those guys were at the best of their time. That was one of the themes that they, that's one of the, that was one of Erwin Miller's big things. He enjoyed the best thinking of his time, which is, you know, a great lesson just to like seek that out, you know, like what is the, if you're going to get an architect, you should get the best one. If you're going to get an artist, you should get the best one. If you're going to get a designer, get the best one. And, at their house, they enlisted, well, his wife was the one also, I believe, who brought in Jean Tinguely and Henry Moore. She was an art aficionado who had really learned a lot. She would come up to New York with Erwin when he was on these boards. He was on the board of like a bunch of, he was on MoMA trustees board. He was on a bunch of like the Chemical Bank and all these like mid-century like titans of industry type of companies. Mm. And so he would come to New York to be on these boards and she would spend her time going down to the galleries in New York. So she was hanging around at like Leo Castelli and Marlboro back in the 50s. And so she kind of became like a serious, serious art patron. There was a funny story where they had an agreement, Erwin and his wife Xenia, that they had to agree on anything they bought art-wise. And she wanted to buy Jasper John's American flag, one of the American flag series. And she brought it home and they put it on the wall for a week and Erwin Miller said he didn't like it because he felt like it was unpatriotic or something. And so they didn't buy it. And it ended up selling for something like $150, 50 years later, it's like in MoMA or something. I'm not sure exactly which one it was, but you know, these paintings are like some of the most famous paintings of that period. And so it's kind of funny that, you know, she was bringing in all this art and alongside he was bringing in all this architecture and they kind of built this amazing collection in the city. And one of the people that she really liked was Alexander Girard. He had come in to work on their first house up in Canada alongside Aero Serenin. Aero Serenin designed them like a country house in Canada and worked with Girard. So Girard, you know, had been working at Cranbrook and up in Bloomfield Hills. So yeah, he was a pretty interesting character. And so they, for their house in Columbus, they brought in Aero Serenin to design the house. And then this guy, Dan Kiley, who was seen as kind of the best landscape designer of that era, to do the gardens, and then Girard to do the interiors. So Girard was a pretty interesting guy. He was kind of like a postmodernist before postmodernists. He would go travel around India and Mexico and find all these amazing patterns and folk art and bring them back. And so their house is this like stark kind of, you know, modernist house with all this, but it's kind of softened by all this Girard textiles and interior design. Like he chose all the chairs and stuff. And so he was a really interesting guy because he was kind of like in that modernist period, but using a lot of like funky colors, textures and patterns and stuff that you would see come back a few years late.
Yeah, it almost seems like his patterns and pastel choices are, it looks like weirdly relevant today. He was a pretty interesting guy though. You know, he was based out of New Mexico, right?
Yeah. Well, I think later.
Later.
He moved to New Mexico from Michigan, but yeah, he was a Santa Fe guy.
Right. What was the process of going around and photographing these? Like, because the photos in the book are like really beautiful too. The whole design is amazing.
Yeah, I have to give a shout out to Studio Lin here in New York. They're in Brooklyn. Alex Lin is an amazing designer who really has done an amazing job on this. You know, we originally had so much content here, it was like, wait a second, we just did 80 years of history on 80 buildings, and we have so much stuff. And you know, we had commissioned Ewan Bond, who's a really well-known architecture photographer, really accomplished, you know, he won the Golden Lion in Venice in 2012, and just a really amazing architecture photographer who had done work on places like Chandigarh, Brasilia, some of these other modernist kind of like places around the world. He expressed interest in coming and was like, okay, great. So he and I went there like four times. And I should also give a shout out to the Landmark Columbus Foundation, Richard McCoy and his team there, who like put so much support behind this project, that it, you know, it wouldn't be what it is without them as well, because they really helped keep the levels of pursuit of excellence. But Ewan and I went four times. He's kind of a documentarian style photographer. A lot of classic architecture photography is very composed, very, very still. It photographs the building right when it's completed, you know, like when there's usually not any people in it. There's, you know, only the kind of furniture they want in it. But you know, that's kind of a modernist sensibility. And I would say Ewan's kind of like, you know, comes after that. And he's much more like kind of documentary. Like I think his background is more in fine art, documentarian kind of photography. And so he goes in and like looks at a building as a kind of backdrop to society, kind of. And so he went around and just tried to photograph them as they are a little bit. Like, you know, he kind of embraces the imperfections of 50 years of use. So the you know, if the blinds are all messed up and in the beautiful glass box, that's kind of a cool moment for him, where like there's signs of life there. And so he did a nice job of capturing the buildings, you know, beautifully and like as they are, kind of you know, amazing works of art, but also kind of getting that kind of the signs of usage in there. He compared it a little bit to Palm Springs, where if you go there, it's like, it's kind of almost like a time capsule, like a museum of modern architecture. It's a lot of houses where everybody keeps them up perfectly and tries to like, you know, they almost like, it's almost like a colonial Williamsburg for mid-century modernism. I love it. It's great, but it's a different thing, right? His attitude is more to kind of capture things as they are. And so he went around and he goes up and you know, we went up in a couple Cessna planes to get aerials. We, he, he suggested we do one in each season, which was cool. So there's some snow shots in there. He just, you know, just giving like a little bit of the angle that you don't always see in the big flashy photography when it's first built. And so, yeah, he captured that. And so that was a challenge, you know, for me. It was like, I have all this historical information, which was way more than I thought it was going to be when I set out to do it, as it usually probably is. He also got there and was like, wow, there's more buildings here than I thought. Like, and so we had so much stuff that we had to have Alex bring it together, you know. He did a good job of making it. He used an encyclopedia as his reference for density of information. Oh, but wow. The book design, really, we're really proud of it.
Yeah, no, it's amazing. It's a behemoth. I was going through it. I have a few questions. So what are your favorite buildings in Columbus? And is there sort of like an emotional attachment to these buildings, considering you grew up around them? Like, give a little bit of like a rundown of some of the more interesting buildings, and maybe even some like personal experiences you remember from like being a kid or something, if you have anything like that.
Yeah, it's always hard, you know, it changes. I've been looking at it so long that I want to give you the hipster response. It's like the most obscure building. Like, you know, there's this one called Smith Elementary School.